Locals believe that a supernatural entity is behind the unseasonably hot sandstorms in Egypt. Can it be true? Sax Rohmer, today on the Classic Tales Podcast. Welcome to the Classic Tales Podcast. Thank you for listening. Thank you to all of our financial supporters. We couldn't do this without you, and we really appreciate your support. We've set it up so that for a $5 monthly donation, you get a monthly coupon code for $8 off any audiobook order. Give more, and you get more. It's a great way to effortlessly build out your classic audiobook library, and you get to help more folks like you discover the classics in a curated and easily accessible format. Go to ClassicTalesAudiobooks.com today and become a financial supporter. You'll be glad you did. Thank you so much. And if you can't support us financially right now, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts so more folks can find us. If you haven't picked up the fourth novel in the Arsène Lupin series, 813, you really need to check it out. Head on over to ClassicTalesAudiobooks.com and pick up this fantastic adventure. And if we sell a few more copies and pick up a few more monthly supporters, we can start working on the fifth in the Arsène Lupin series. Don't miss this extraordinary thriller. Last night, we had our little family's Halloween party. We carved pumpkins, and Scylla made pumpkin soup, which was amazing. She doesn't have a recipe, she just kind of developed this way of making it. Cream, onions, and a ton of squashes. It was so good. We watched Bride of Frankenstein and Plan 9 from Outer Space while we carved away. We have a really deep porch in our house. 21 years ago, when we first saw this house and we were house shopping, when Scylla first saw this house, her first thought was that this porch would be perfect when lined with pumpkins and jack-o'-lanterns. She was right. As a final note, Scylla read some of the kids' picture books from when they were little. It was such a wonderful, fun evening just being together. Happy Halloween, everyone. A quick note on our story. Sax Rohmer's work is pretty problematic. I mean, there's no reason to point out that the vampire in last week's episode was a Jewess for any other reason than being anti-Semitic. It didn't add anything to the plot or character, but for some reason, Sax Rohmer needed to make the darkest villain we've seen so far a Jewess. Sentiments such as these really shouldn't go unaddressed. I just wanted to point that out. And now, The Night of the Necropolis, Part 4 of 8, by Sax Rohmer. Chapter 11, Cairo. The exact manner in which mental stress will affect a man's physical health is often difficult to predict. Robert Cairn was in the pink of condition at the time that he left Oxford to take up his London appointment. But the tremendous nervous strain wrought upon him by this series of events, wholly outside the radius of normal things, had broken him up physically, where it might have left unscathed a more highly strung, though less physically vigorous man. Those who have passed through a nerve storm such as this which had laid him low will know that convalescence seems like a welcome awakening from a dreadful dream. It was indeed in a state between awaking and dreaming that Robert Cairn took counsel with his father, the latter more pale than was his wont and somewhat anxious-eyed, and determined upon an Egyptian rest cure.
"I've made it all right at the office, Rob," said Dr. Cairn. "In 3 weeks or so, you will receive instructions at Cairo to write up a series of local articles. Until then, my boy, complete rest and don't worry. Above all, don't worry. You and I have passed through a Saturnalia of horror, and you, less inured to horrors than I, have gone down. I don't wonder. Where is Anthony Ferrara? Dr. Cairns shook his head, and his eyes gleamed with a sudden anger. For God's sake, don't mention his name, he said. That topic is taboo, Rob. I may tell you, however, that he has left England. In this unreal frame of mind, then, and as one but partly belonging to the world of things actual, Cairn found himself an invalid, who but yesterday had been a hale man, found himself shipped for Port Said, found himself entrained for Cairo, and, with an awakening to the realities of life, and emerging from an ill dream to lively interest in the novelties of Egypt, found himself following the red-jerseyed shepherd's porter along the corridor of the train and out onto the platform. A short drive through those singular streets where east meets west and mingles, in the sudden, violet dusk of Lower Egypt, and he was amid the bustle of the popular hotel. Sime was there, whom he had last seen at Oxford. Sime, the phlegmatic. He apologized for not meeting the train, but explained that his duties had rendered it impossible. Sime was attached temporarily to an archaeological expedition as medical man, and his athletic and somewhat bovine appearance contrasted oddly with the unhealthy gauntness of Cairn.
I only got in from Wasta 10 minutes ago, Cairn. You must come out to the camp when I return. The desert air will put you on your feet again in no time.
Sime was unemotional, but there was concern in his voice and in his glance, for the change in Cairn was very startling. Although he knew something, if but very little, of certain happenings in London, gruesome happenings centering around the man called Anthony Ferrara, he avoided any reference to them at the moment. Seated upon the terrace, Robert Cairn studied the busy life in the street below with all the interest of a new arrival in the capital of the Near East. More than ever now, his illness and the things which had led up to it seemed to belong to a remote dream existence. Through the railings at his feet, a hawker was thrusting fly whisks and imploring him in complicated English to purchase one. Vendors of beads, of fictitious antiques, of sweetmeats, of whatnot, fortune tellers, and all that chattering horde, which some obscure process of gravitation seems to hurl against the terrace of shepherds, buzzed about him. Carriages and motor cars, camels and donkeys mingled in the Sharia Kamal Pasha. Voices American, voices Anglo-Saxon, guttural German tones, and softly murmured Arabic merged into one indescribably chord of sound. But to Robert Cairn, it was all unspeakably restful. He was quite contented to sit there sipping his whiskey and soda and smoking his pipe. Sheer idleness was good for him, and exactly what he wanted. And idling amid that unique throng is idleness deluxe. Sime watched him covertly, and saw that his face had acquired lines, lines which told of the fires through which he had passed. Something, it was evident, something horrible, had seared his mind. Considering the many indications of tremendous nervous disaster in Cairn, Sime wondered how near his companion had come to insanity, and concluded that he had stood upon the frontiers of that grim land of phantoms, and had only been plucked back in the 11th hour. Cairn glanced around with a smile from the group of hawkers who solicited his attention upon the pavement below.
This is a delightful scene, he said. I could sit here for hours, but considering that it's some time after sunset, it remains unusually hot, doesn't it?
Rather, replied Sime. They are expecting Khamsin, the hot wind, you know. I was up the river a week ago, and we struck it badly in Aswan. It grew as black as night, and one couldn't breathe for sand. It's probably working down to Cairo.
From your description, I am not anxious to make the acquaintance of Khamsin.
Sime shook his head, knocking out his pipe into the ashtray.
This is a funny country, he said reflectively. The most weird ideas prevail here to this day. Ideas which properly belong to the Middle Ages. For instance. He began to recharge the hot bowl. It is not really time for Khamsin. Consequently, the natives feel called upon to hunt up some explanation of its unexpected appearance. Their ideas on the subject are interesting, if idiotic. One of our Arabs, we are excavating at the Fayum, you know, solemnly assured me yesterday that the hot wind had been caused by an Ifrit, a sort of Arabian Nights demon, who has arrived in Egypt. He laughed gruffly, but Cairn was staring at him with a curious expression. Sime continued. When I got to Cairo this evening, I found news of the Ifrit had preceded me. Honestly, Cairn, it is all over the town. The native town, I mean. All the shopkeepers in the Muski are talking about it. If a puff of Khamsin should come, I believe they would permanently shut up shop and hide in their cellars, if they have any. I am rather hazy on modern Egyptian architecture. Cairn nodded his head, absently. You laugh, he said. But the active force of a superstition, what we call a superstition, is sometimes a terrible thing. Sima stared. Eh? The medical man had suddenly come uppermost. He recollected that this class of discussion was probably taboo. You may doubt the existence of Ifrits, continued Cairn, but neither you nor I can doubt the creative power of thought. If a trained hypnotist, by sheer concentration, can persuade his subject that the latter sits upon the brink of a river fishing, when actually he sits upon a platform in a lecture room, what result should you expect from a concentration of thousands of native minds upon the idea that an Ifrit is visiting Egypt? Sime stared in a dull way peculiar to him. Rather a poser, he said. I have a glimmer of a notion what you mean. Don't you think? If you mean, don't I think the result would be the creation of an Ifrit? No, I don't. I hardly mean that either, replied Cairn. But this wave of superstition cannot be entirely unproductive. All that thought energy directed to one point. Sima stood up. We shall get out of our depth, he replied conclusively. He considered the ground of discussion an unhealthy one. This was the territory adjoining that of insanity. A fortune teller from India proffered his services incessantly. Imshi, imshi, growled Sime. Hold on, said Cairn, smiling. This chap is not an Egyptian. Let us ask him if he has heard the rumor respecting the Ifrit. Sime reseated himself rather unwillingly. The fortune teller spread his little carpet and knelt down in order to read the palm of his hypothetical client, but Cairn waved him aside. I don't want my fortune told, he said, but I will give you your fee, with a smile at Sime, for a few minutes' conversation. Yes, sir, yes, sir. The Indian was all attention. Why, Cairn pointed forensically at the fortune teller. Why is Khamsin come so early this year? The Indian spread his hands, palms upward. How should I know? He replied in his soft, melodious voice. I am not of Egypt. I can only say what is told to me by the Egyptians. And what is told to you? Sime rested his hands upon his knees, bending forward curiously. He was palpably anxious that Cairn should have confirmation of the Ifrit story from the Indian. They tell me, sir, the man's voice sank musically low, that a thing very evil. He tapped a long brown finger upon his breast. Not as I am. He tapped Sime upon the knee. Not as he, your friend. He thrust a long finger at Cairn. Not as you, sir. Not a man at all, though something like a man, not having any father and mother. You mean, suggested Sime, a spirit?
The fortune teller shook his head.
They tell me, sir, not a spirit. A man, but not as other men. A very, very bad man. One that the great king long, long ago, the king you call wise.
Solomon, suggested Cairn.
Yes, yes, Suleiman. One that he, when he banish all the tribe of the demons from the earth, one that he not found.
One he overlooked? Jerked Sime.
Yes, yes, overlook. A very evil man, my gentleman. They tell me he has come to Egypt. He come not from the sea, but across the great desert.
The Libyan desert? Suggested Sime. The man shook his head, seeking for words.
The Arabian desert? No, no. Away beyond, far up in Africa.
He waved his long arms dramatically.
Far, far up, beyond the Sudan.
The Sahara Desert? Proposed Sime.
Yes, yes, it is Sahara Desert. Come across the Sahara Desert and is come to Khartoum.
How did he get there? Asked Cairn. The Indian shrugged his shoulders.
I cannot say. But next he come to Wadi Halfa, then he is in Aswan, and from Aswan he come down to Luxor. Yesterday an Egyptian friend told me, Khamsin is in the Fayum, therefore he is there, the man of evil, for he bring the hot wind with him.
The Indian was growing impressive, and two American tourists stopped to listen to his words.
Tonight, tomorrow.
He spoke now almost in a whisper, glancing about him as if apprehensive of being overheard.
He may be here in Cairo, bringing with him the scorching breath of the desert, the scorpion wind.
He stood up, casting off the mystery with which he had invested his story, and smiling insinuatingly. His work was done. His fee was due. Sime rewarded him with 5 piastres. And he departed, bowing.
You know, Sime,
Cairn began to speak, staring absently the while after the fortune-teller, as he descended the carpeted steps and rejoined the throng on the sidewalk below.
You know, if a man, anyone, could take advantage of such a wave of thought as this which is now sweeping through Egypt, if he could cause it to concentrate upon him, as it were. Don't you think that it would enable him to transcend the normal? To do phenomenal things?
And by what process should you propose to make yourself such a focus?
I was speaking impersonally, Sime. It might be possible.
It might be possible to dress for dinner, snapped Sime. If we shut up talking nonsense, there's a carnival here tonight. Great fun. Suppose we concentrate our brainwaves on another scotch and soda.
Chapter 12. The Mask of Set. Above the palm trees swept the jeweled vault of Egypt's sky, and set amid the clustering leaves gleamed little red electric lamps. Fairy lanterns outlined the winding paths, and paper Japanese lamps hung dancing in long rows, whilst in the center of the enchanted garden, a fountain spurned diamond spray high in the air to fall back coolly plashing into the marble home of the golden carp. The rustling of innumerable feet upon the sandy pathway and the ceaseless murmur of voices, with pealing laughter rising above all, could be heard amid the strains of the military band ensconced in a flower-covered arbor. Into the brightly lighted places, and back into the luminous shadows, came and went fantastic forms. Sheikhs there were with flowing robes, dragomans who spoke no Arabic, sultans and priests of ancient Egypt going arm in arm, dancing girls of old Thebes, and harem ladies in silken trousers and high-heeled red shoes, queens of Babylon and Cleopatra's, many geishas and desert gypsies mingled, specks in a giant kaleidoscope. The thick carpet of confetti rustled to the tread. Girls ran screaming before those who pursued them, armed with handfuls of the tiny paper discs. Pipers of a Highland regiment marched piping through the throng, their Scottish kilts seeming wildly incongruous amid such a scene. Within the hotel, where the mosque lanterns glowed, one might catch a glimpse of the heads of dancers gliding shadow-like.
"A tremendous crowd," said Sime, "considering it is nearly the end of the season."
Three silken ladies, wearing gauzy white yashmaks, confronted Cairn and the speaker. A gleaming of jeweled fingers there was, and Cairn found himself half-choked with confetti, which filled his eyes, his nose, his ears, and of which quite a liberal amount found access to his mouth. The three ladies of the yashmak ran screaming from their vengeance-seeking victims, Sime pursuing two, and Cairn hard upon the heels of the third. Amid this scene of riotous carnival, all else was forgotten, and only the madness, the infectious madness of the night, claimed his mind. In and out of the strangely attired groups darted his agile quarry, all but captured a score of times, but always eluding him. Sime he had hopelessly lost, as around fountain and flower bed, arbor and palm trunk, he leapt in pursuit of the elusive yashmak. Then, in a shadowed corner of the garden, he trapped her. Plunging his hand into the bag of confetti which he carried, he leapt, exulting to his revenge, when a sudden gust of wind passed sibilantly through the palm tops, and glancing upward, Cairn saw that the blue sky was overcast, and the stars gleaming dimly as through a veil. That moment of hesitancy proved fatal to his project, for, with a little excited scream, the girl dived under his outstretched arm and fled back towards the fountain. He turned to pursue again, when a second puff of wind, stronger than the first, set waving the palm fronds and showered dry leaves upon the confetti carpet of the garden. The band played loudly. The murmur of conversation rose to something like a roar, but above it whistled the increasing breeze. And there was a sort of grittiness in the air. Then, proclaimed by a furious lashing of the fronds above, burst the wind in all its fury. It seemed to beat down into the garden in waves of heat. Huge leaves began to fall from the treetops, and the mast-like trunks bent before the fury from the desert. The atmosphere grew hazy with impalpable dust, and the stars were wholly obscured. Commenced a stampede from the garden. Shrill with fear rose a woman's scream from the heart of the throng. "A scorpion! A scorpion!" Panic threatened, but fortunately the doors were wide, so that without disaster the whole fantastic company passed into the hotel, and even the military band retired. Cairn perceived that he alone remained in the garden, and glancing along the path in the direction of the fountain, he saw a blotchy, drab creature, fully 4 inches in length, running zigzag towards him. It was a huge scorpion. But even as he leapt forward to crush it, it turned and crept in amid the tangle of flowers beside the path, where it was lost from view. The scorching wind grew momentarily fiercer, and Cairn, entering behind a few straggling revelers, found something ominous and dreadful in its sudden fury. At the threshold, he turned and looked back upon the gaily lighted garden. The paper lamps were thrashing in the wind, many extinguished. Others were in flames. A number of electric globes fell from their fastenings amid the palm tops and burst bomb-like upon the ground. The pleasure garden was now a battlefield, beset with dangers, and he fully appreciated the anxiety of the company to get within doors. Where chrysanthemum and yashmak turban and tarbush, ureus and Indian plume had mingled gaily, no soul remained. But yet, he was in error. Someone did remain. As if embodying the fear that, in a few short minutes, had emptied the garden, out
beneath the waving lanterns, the flying debris, the whirling dust, pacing somberly from shadow to light and to shadow again, advancing towards the hotel steps, came the figure of one sandaled, and wearing the short white tunic of ancient Egypt. His arms were bare, and he carried a long staff, but rising hideously upon his shoulders was a crocodile mask, which seemed to grin. The mask of Set, Set the Destroyer, God of the Underworld. Cairn, alone of all the crowd, saw the strange figure, for the reason that Cairn alone faced towards the garden. The gruesome mask seemed to fascinate him. He could not take his gaze from that weird advancing god. He felt impelled hypnotically to stare at the gleaming eyes set in the Saurian head. The mask was at the foot of the steps, and still Cairn stood rigid. When, as the sandaled foot was set upon the first step, a breeze, dust-laden and hot as from a furnace door, blew fully into the hotel, blinding him. A chorus arose from the crowd at his back, and many voices cried out for the doors to be shut. Someone tapped him on the shoulder and spun him about.
By God!
It was Sime who now had him by the arm.
Khamsin has come with a vengeance. They tell me that they have never had anything like it.
The native servants were closing and fastening the doors. The night was now as black as Erebus, and the wind was howling about the building with the voices of a million lost souls. Cairn glanced back across his shoulder. Men were drawing heavy curtains across the doors and windows. They have shut him out, Sime, he said. Sime stared in his dull fashion.
You surely saw him, persisted Cairn irritably. The man in the mask of Set. He was coming in just behind me.
Sime strode forward, pulled the curtains aside, and peered out into the deserted garden.
Not a soul, old man, he declared. You must have seen the Ifrit.
Chapter 13. The Scorpion Wind. This sudden and appalling change of weather had sadly affected the mood of the gathering. That part of the carnival planned to take place in the garden was perforce abandoned, together with the firework display. A half-hearted attempt was made at dancing, but the howling of the wind and the omnipresent dust perpetually reminded the pleasure-seekers that Khamsin raged without, raged with a violence unparalleled in the experience of the oldest residents. This was a full-fledged sandstorm, a terror of the Sahara descended upon Cairo. But there were few departures, although many of the visitors, who had long distances to go, especially those from Mina House, discussed the advisability of leaving before this unique storm should have grown even worse. The general tendency, though, was markedly gregarious. Safety seemed to be with the crowd, amid the gaiety, where music and laughter were, rather than in the sand-swept streets.
"Guess we've outstayed our welcome," confided an American lady to Sime. "Egypt wants to drive us all home now."
"Possibly," he replied with a smile. "The season has run very late this year, and so this sort of thing is more or less to be expected."
The orchestra struck up a lively one-step, and a few of the more enthusiastic dancers accepted the invitation. But the bulk of the company thronged around the edge of the floor, acting as spectators. Cairn and Sime wedged a way through the heterogeneous crowd to the American bar.
"I prescribe a tango," said Sime.
"A tango is..."
"A tango," explained Sime, "is a new kind of cocktail sacred to this buffet. Try it. It will either kill you or cure you."
Cairn smiled rather wanly.
"I must confess that I need bucking up a bit," he said. "That confounded sand seems to have got me by the throat."
Sime briskly gave his orders to the bar attendant.
"You know," pursued Cairn, I cannot get out of my head the idea that there was someone wearing a crocodile mask in the garden a while ago.
Look here, growled Sime, studying the operations of the cocktail manufacturer. Suppose there were. What about it?
Well, it's odd that nobody else saw him.
I suppose it hasn't occurred to you that the fellow might have removed his mask?
Cairn shook his head slowly.
I don't think so, he declared. I haven't seen him anywhere in the hotel.
Seen him?
Sima turned his dull gaze upon the speaker.
How should you know him?
Cairn raised his hand to his forehead in an oddly helpless way.
No, of course not. It's very extraordinary.
They took their seats at a small table, and in mutual silence loaded and lighted their pipes. Sima, in common with many young and enthusiastic medical men, had theories. Theories of that revolutionary sort, which only harsh experience can shatter. Secretly, he was disposed to ascribe all the ills to which flesh is heir primarily to a disordered nervous system. It was evident that Cairn's mind persistently ran along a particular groove. Something lay back of all this erratic talk. He had clearly invested the mask of Set with a curious individuality.
I gather that you had a stiff bout of it in London?
Sime said suddenly. Cairn nodded. Beastly stiff.
There is a lot of sound reason in your nervous theory, Sime.
It was touch and go with me for days, I am told.
Yet pathologically, I was a hale man. That would seem to show how nerves can kill. Just a series of shocks, horrors, one piled upon another, did as much for me as influenza, pneumonia, and two or three other ailments together could have done.
Sima shook his head wisely. This was in accordance with his ideas.
You know Anthony Ferrara? Continued Cairn.
Well, he has done this for me. His damnable practices are worse than any disease.
Sime, the man is a pestilence. Although the law cannot touch him, although no jury can convict him, he is a murderer. He controls forces.
Sime was watching him intently.
It will give you some idea, Sime, of the pitch to which things had come. When I tell you that my father drove to Ferrara's rooms one night with a loaded revolver in his pocket.
For,
Sima hesitated.
For protection?
No. Cairn leant forward across the table.
To shoot him, Sima. Shoot him on sight, as one shoots a mad dog.
Are you serious? As God is my witness. If Anthony Ferrara had been in his rooms that night, my father would have killed him.
It would have been a shocking scandal. It would have been a martyrdom. The man who removes Anthony Ferrara from the earth will be doing mankind a service worthy of the highest reward. He is unfit to live. Sometimes I cannot believe that he does live. I expect to wake up and find that he was a figure of a particularly evil dream.
This incident, the call at his rooms, occurred just before your illness?
The thing which he had attempted that night was the last straw, Sime. It broke me down. From the time that he left Oxford, Anthony Ferrara has pursued a deliberate course of crime. Of crime so cunning, so unusual, and based upon such amazing and unholy knowledge that no breath of suspicion has touched him.
Sime, you remember a girl I told you about at Oxford one evening? A girl who came to visit him?
Sime nodded slowly.
Well, he killed her.
Oh, there is no doubt about it. I saw her body in the hospital.
How had he killed her then?
How? Only he and the God who permits him to exist can answer that, Sime.
He killed her without coming anywhere near her. And he killed his adoptive father, Sir Michael Ferrara, by the same unholy means.
Sima watched him, but offered no comment.
It was hushed up, of course. There is no existing law which could be used against him.
Existing law?
They are ruled out, Sime. the laws that could have reached him, but he would have been burnt at the stake in the Middle Ages.
I see.
Sime drummed his fingers upon the table.
You had those ideas about him at Oxford. And does Dr. Cairn seriously believe the same?
He does.
So would you.
You could not doubt it, Sime, not for a moment, if you had seen what we have seen.
His eyes blazed into a sudden fury, suggestive of his old, robust self. He tried night after night by means of the same accursed sorcery, which everyone thought buried in the ruins of Thebes, to kill me. He projected things.
Suggested these things to your mind?
Something like that. I saw, or thought I saw, and smelt,
pah, I seem to smell them now, beetles. Mummy beetles, you know, from the skull of a mummy. My rooms were thick with them. It brought me very near to bedlam, Sime.
Oh,
it was not merely imaginary. My father and I caught him red-handed.
He glanced across at the other.
You read of the death of Lord Lashmore? It was just after you came out.
Yes.
Heart.
It was his heart, yes. But Ferrara was responsible. That was the business which led my father to drive to Ferrara's rooms with a loaded revolver in his pocket.
The wind was shaking the windows and whistling about the building with a demoniacal fury, as if seeking admission. The band played a popular waltz, and in and out of the open doors came and went groups representative of many ages and many nationalities.
Ferrara, began Sime slowly, was always a detestable man, with his sleek black hair and ivory face. Those long eyes of his had an expression which always tempted me to hit him. Sir Michael, if what you say is true, and after all, Cairn, it only goes to show how little we know of the nervous system, literally took a viper to his bosom.
He did. Anthony Ferrara was his adopted son, of course. God knows to what evil brood he really belongs.
Both were silent for a while. Then,
gracious heavens!
Cairn started to his feet so wildly as almost to upset the table.
Look, Sime! Look!
He cried. Sime was not the only man in the bar to hear and to heed his words. Sime, looking in the direction indicated by Cairn's extended finger, received a vague impression that a grotesque, long-headed figure had appeared momentarily in the doorway opening upon the room where the dancers were. Then it was gone again, if it had ever been there, and he was supporting Cairn, who swayed dizzily and had become ghastly pale. Sime imagined that the heated air had grown suddenly even more heated. Curious eyes were turned upon his companion, who now sank back into his chair, muttering,
"The mask! The mask!"
"I think I saw the chap who seems to worry you so much," said Sime soothingly. "Wait here. I will tell the waiter to bring you a dose of brandy, and whatever you do, don't get excited."
He made for the door, pausing and giving an order to a waiter on his way, and pushed into the crowd outside. It was long past midnight, and the gaiety, which had been resumed, seemed of a forced and feverish sort. Some of the visitors were leaving, and a breath of hot wind swept in from the open doors. A pretty girl wearing a yashmak, who, with two similarly attired companions, was making her way to the entrance, attracted his attention. She seemed to be on the point of swooning. He recognized the trio for the same that had pelted Cairn and himself with confetti earlier in the evening.
"The sudden heat has affected your friend," he said, stepping up to them. "My name is Dr. Sime. May I offer you my assistance?"
The offer was accepted, and with the three he passed out onto the terrace, where the dust grated beneath the tread, and helped the fainting girl into an arabia. The night was thunderously black, the heat almost insufferable, and the tall palms in front of the hotel bowed before the might of the scorching wind. As the vehicle drove off,
Sime stood for a moment, looking after it. His face was very grave, for there was a look in the bright eyes of the girl in the yashmak, which, professionally, he did not like. Turning up the steps, he learnt from the manager that several visitors had succumbed to the heat. There was something furtive in the manner of his informant's glance, and Sime looked at him significantly.
"Kamsin brings clouds of septic dust with it," he said. "Let us hope that these attacks are due to nothing more than the unexpected rise in the temperature."
An air of uneasiness prevailed now throughout the hotel. The wind had considerably abated. The crowds were leaving, pouring from the steps into the deserted street, a dreamlike company. Colonel Royland took Sime aside, as the latter was making his way back to the buffet. The colonel, whose regiment was stationed at the Citadel, had known Sime almost from childhood.
"You know, my boy," he said, "I should never have allowed Eileen," his daughter, "to remain in Cairo, if I had foreseen this change in the weather. This infernal wind coming right through the native town is loaded with infection."
"Has it affected her, then?" asked Sime anxiously.
"She nearly fainted in the ballroom," replied the colonel. "Her mother took her home half an hour ago. I looked for you everywhere, but couldn't find you."
"Quite a number have succumbed," said Sime.
"Eileen seems to be slightly hysterical," continued the colonel. "She persisted that someone wearing a crocodile mask had been standing beside her at the moment that she was taken ill."
Sime started. Perhaps Cairn's story was not a matter of imagination after all. "There is someone here dressed like that, I believe," he replied with affected carelessness. "He seems to have frightened several people. Any idea who he is?"
"My dear chap," cried the colonel, "I've been searching the place for him, but I have never once set eyes upon him. I was about to ask if you knew anything about it."
Sime returned to the table where Cairn was sitting. The latter seemed to have recovered somewhat, but he looked far from well. Sime stared at him critically.
"I should turn in," he said, "if I were you. Kamsin is playing the deuce with people. I only hope it does not justify its name and blow for 50 days.
"Have you seen the man in the mask?"
asked Cairn.
"No," replied Sime. "But he's here all right. Others have seen him."
Cairn stood up rather unsteadily, and with Sime made his way through the moving crowd to the stairs. The band was still playing, but the cloud of gloom which had settled upon the place refused to be dissipated.
"Good night, Cairn," said Sime. "See you in the morning."
Robert Cairn, with aching head and a growing sensation of nausea, paused on the landing, looking down into the court below. He could not disguise from himself that he felt ill. Not nervously ill, as in London, but physically sick. This superheated air was difficult to breathe. It seemed to rise in waves from below. Then, from a weary glancing at the figures beneath him, his attitude changed to one of tense watching. A man, wearing the crocodile mask of Set, stood by a huge urn containing a palm, looking up to the landing. Cairn's weakness left him, and in its place came an indescribable anger, a longing to drive his fist into that grinning mask. He turned and ran lightly down the stairs, conscious of a sudden glow of energy. Reaching the floor, he saw the mask making across the hall, in the direction of the outer door. As rapidly as possible, for he could not run without attracting undesirable attention, Cairn followed. The figure of Set passed out onto the terrace. But when Cairn in turn swung open the door, his quarry had vanished. Then, in an arabiya just driving off, he detected the hideous mask. Hatless as he was, he ran down the steps and threw himself into another. The carriage controller was in attendance, and Cairn rapidly told him to instruct the driver to follow the arabiya which had just left. The man lashed up his horses, turned the carriage, and went galloping on after the retreating figure. Past the Espekia gardens they went, through several narrow streets, and on to the quarter of the Muski. Time after time, he thought he had lost the carriage ahead, but his own driver's knowledge of the tortuous streets enabled him always to overtake it again. They went rocking along lanes so narrow that with outstretched arms one could almost have touched the walls on either side. Past empty shops and unlighted houses, Cairn had not the remotest idea of his whereabouts, save that he was evidently in the district of the bazaars. A right-angled corner was abruptly negotiated, and there, ahead of him, stood the pursued vehicle. The driver was turning his horses around to return. His fare was disappearing from sight into the black shadows of a narrow alley on the left. Cairn leaped from the arabia, shouting to the man to wait, and went dashing down the sloping lane after the retreating figure. A sort of blind fury possessed him, but he never paused to analyze it, never asked himself by what right he pursued this man, what wrong the latter had done him. His action was wholly unreasoning. He knew that he wished to overtake the wearer of the mask and to tear it from his head. Upon that, he acted. He discovered that despite the tropical heat of the night, he was shuddering with cold, but he disregarded this circumstance and ran on. The pursued stopped before an iron-studded door, which was opened instantly. He entered as the runner came up with him, and before the door could be reclosed, Cairn thrust his way in. Blackness, utter blackness, was before him. The figure which he had pursued seemed to have been swallowed up. He stumbled on, gropingly, hands outstretched, then fell. Fell, as he realized in the moment of falling, down a short flight of stone steps. Still amid utter blackness, he got upon his feet, shaken but otherwise unhurt by his fall. He turned about, expecting to see some glimmer of light from the stairway. But the blackness was unbroken. Silence and gloom hemmed him in. He stood for a moment, listening intently. A shaft of light pierced the darkness, as a shutter was thrown open. Through an iron-barred window the light shone, and with the light came a breath of stifling perfume. That perfume carried his imagination back instantly to a room at Oxford, and he advanced and looked through into the place beyond. He drew a swift breath, clutched the bars, and was silent, stricken speechless. He looked into a large and lofty room, lighted by several hanging lamps. It had a carpeted divan at one end, and was otherwise scantily furnished, in the Eastern manner. A silver incense burner smoked upon a large praying carpet, and by it stood the man in the crocodile mask. An Arab girl, fantastically attired, who had evidently just opened the shutters, was now helping him to remove the hideous headdress. She presently untied the last of the fastenings and lifted the thing from the man's shoulders, moving away with the gliding step of the Oriental, and leaving him standing there in his short white tunic, bare-legged and sandaled. The smoke of the incense curled upward and played around the straight, slim figure, drew vaporous lines about the still, ivory face, the handsome, sinister face, sometimes partly veiling the long black eyes, and sometimes showing them in all their unnatural brightness. So the man stood, looking towards the barred window. It was Antony Ferrara.
"Ah, dear Cairn."
The husky, musical voice smote upon Cairn's ears as the most hated sound in nature.
"You have followed me. Not content with driving me from London, you would also render Cairo, my dear Cairo, untenable for me."
Cairn clutched the bars but was silent.
"How wrong of you, Cairn," the soft voice mocked. "This attention is so harmful to you. Do you know, Cairn, the Sudanese formed the extraordinary opinion that I was an ifrit. and this strange reputation has followed me right down the Nile. Your father, my dear friend, has studied these odd matters, and he would tell you that there is no power in nature higher than the human will. Actually, Cairn, they have ascribed to me the direction of the Khamsin, and so many worthy Egyptians have made up their minds that I travel with the storm, or that the storm follows me, that something of the kind has really come to pass. Or is it merely coincidence, Cairn? Who can say? Motionless, immobile, save for a slow smile, Antony Ferrara stood, and Cairn kept his eyes upon the evil face, and with trembling hands clutched the bars. "It is certainly odd, is it not?" resumed the taunting voice. "That Khamsin, so violent too, should thus descend upon the Cairene season. I only arrived from the Fayum this evening, Cairn, and do you know they have the pestilence there? I trust the hot wind does not carry it to Cairo. There are so many distinguished European and American visitors here. It would be a thousand pities." Cairn released his grip of the bars, raised his clenched fists above his head, and in a voice and with a maniacal fury that were neither his own, cursed the man who stood there mocking him. Then he reeled, fell, and remembered no more. "All right, old man, you'll do quite nicely now." It was Sime speaking. Cairn struggled upright and found himself in bed. Sime was seated beside him. "Don't talk," said Sime. "You're in hospital. I'll do the talking. You listen. I saw you bolt out of Shepherd's last night. Shut up. I followed, but lost you. We got up a search party, and with the aid of the man who had driven you, ran you to earth in a dirty alley behind the mosque of El Azhar. 4 kindly mendicants, who reside upon the steps of the establishment, had been awakened by your blundering in among them. They were holding you. Yes, you were raving pretty badly. You're a lucky man, Cairn. You were inoculated before you left home?" Cairn nodded weakly. "Saved you. Be all right in a couple of days. That damned Khamsin has brought a whiff of the plague from somewhere. Curiously enough, over 50% of the cases spotted so far are people who are at the carnival. Some of them, Cairn, but we won't discuss that now. I was afraid of it last night. That's why I kept an eye on you. My boy, you were delirious when you bolted out of the hotel."
"Was I?" said Cairn wearily, and lay back on the pillow. "Perhaps I was."
Chapter 14. Dr. Cairn arrives. Dr. Bruce Cairn stepped into the boat which was to take him ashore, and as it swung away from the side of the liner, sought to divert his thoughts by a contemplation of the weird scene. Amid the smoky flare of many lights, amid rising clouds of dust, a line of laden toilers was crawling, ant-like, from the lighters into the bowels of the big ship. And a second line, unladen, was descending by another gangway. Above, the jeweled velvet of the sky swept in a glorious arc. Beyond, the lights of Port Said broke through the black curtain of the night, and the moving ray from the lighthouse intermittently swept the harbor waters, whilst, amid the indescribable clamor, the grimily picturesque turmoil, so characteristic of the place, the liner took in coal for her run to Rangoon. Dodging this way and that, rounding the sterns of big ships and disputing the waterway with lesser craft, the boat made for shore. The usual delay at the custom house, the usual soothing of the excited officials in the usual way,
and his Arabia was jolting Dr. Cairn through the noise and the smell of those rambling streets, a noise and a smell entirely peculiar to this clearinghouse of the Near East. He accepted the room which was offered to him at the hotel without troubling to inspect it, and having left instructions that he was to be called in time for the early train to Cairo, he swallowed a whiskey and soda at the buffet and wearily ascended the stairs. There were tourists in the hotel, English and American, marked by a gaping wonderment and loud with plans of sightseeing. But Port Said, nay, all Egypt, had nothing of novelty to offer Dr. Cairn. He was there at great inconvenience. A practitioner of his repute may not easily arrange to quit London at a moment's notice. But the business upon which he was come was imperative. For him, the charm of the place had not existence. But somewhere in Egypt his son stood in deadly peril, and Dr. Cairn counted the hours that yet divided them. His soul was up in arms against the man whose evil schemes had led to his presence in Port Said, at a time when many sufferers required his ministrations in Half Moon Street. He was haunted by a phantom, a ghoul in human shape, Anthony Ferrara, the adopted son of his dear friend, the adopted son who had murdered his adopter, who, whilst guiltless in the eyes of the law, was blood guilty in the eyes of God. Dr. Cairn switched on the light and seated himself upon the side of the bed, knitting his brows and staring straight before him, with an expression in his clear gray eyes whose significance he would have denied hotly had any man charged him with it. He was thinking of Anthony Ferrara's record, the victims of this fiendish youth, for Anthony Ferrara was barely of age, seemed to stand before him with hands stretched out appealingly. "You alone," they seemed to cry, "know who and what he is. You alone know of our awful wrongs. You alone can avenge them." And yet he had hesitated. It had remained for his own flesh and blood to be threatened ere he had taken decisive action. The viper had lain within his reach, and he had neglected to set his heel upon it. Men and women had suffered and had died of its venom, and he had not crushed it. Then Robert, his son, had felt the poison fang, and Dr. Cairn, who had hesitated to act upon the behalf of all humanity, had leapt to arms. He charged himself with apparent selfishness, and his conscience would hear no defense. Dimly, the turmoil from the harbor reached him where he sat. He listened dully to the hooting of a siren, that of some vessel coming out of the canal. His thoughts were evil company, and with a deep sigh he rose, crossed the room and threw open the double windows, giving access to the balcony. Port Said, a panorama of twinkling lights, lay beneath him. The beam from the lighthouse swept the town searchingly like the eye of some pagan god, lustful for sacrifice. He imagined that he could hear the shouting of the gangs coaling the liner in the harbor, but the night was full of the remote murmuring, inseparable from that gateway of the east. The streets below, white under the moon, looked empty and deserted, and the hotel beneath him gave up no sound to tell of the many birds of passage who sheltered within it. A stunning sense of his loneliness came to him. His physical loneliness was symbolic of that which characterized his place in the world. He alone had the knowledge and the power to crush Anthony Ferrara. He alone could rid the world of the unnatural menace embodied in the person bearing that name. The town lay beneath his eyes, but now he saw nothing of it. Before his mental vision loomed exclusively the figure of a slim and strangely handsome young man, having jet-black hair, lusterless, a face of uniform ivory hue, long dark eyes wherein lurked lambent fires, and a womanish grace expressed in his whole bearing and emphasized by his long, white hands. Upon a finger of the left hand gleamed a strange green stone. Antony Ferrara, in the eyes of this solitary traveler, who stood looking down upon Port Said, that figure filled the entire landscape of Egypt. With a weary sigh, Dr. Cairn turned and began to undress. Leaving the windows open, he switched off the light and got into bed. He was very weary, with a weariness rather of the spirit than of the flesh. But it was of that sort which renders sleep all but impossible. Around and about one fixed point his thoughts circled. In vain he endeavored to forget for a while Antony Ferrara and the things connected with him. Sleep was imperative if he would be in fit condition to cope with the matters which demanded his attention in Cairo. Yet sleep defied him. Every trifling sound from the harbor and the canal seemed to rise upon the still air to his room. Through a sort of mist created by the mosquito curtains, he could see the open windows and look out upon the stars. He found himself studying the heavens with sleepless eyes and idly working out the constellations visible. Then one very bright star attracted the whole of his attention, and with the dogged persistency of insomnia, he sought to place it, but could not determine to which group it belonged. So he lay with his eyes upon the stars until the other veiled lamps of heaven became invisible, and the patch of sky no more than a setting for that one white orb. In this contemplation he grew restful. His thoughts ceased feverishly to race along that one hateful groove. The bright star seemed to soothe him. As a result of his fixed gazing, it now appeared to have increased in size. It was a common optical delusion, upon which he scarcely speculated at all. He recognized the welcome approach of sleep, and deliberately concentrated his mind upon the globe of light. Yes, a globe of light indeed, for now it had assumed the dimensions of a lesser moon, and it seemed to rest in the space between the open windows. Then he thought that it crept still nearer. The realities, the bed, the mosquito curtain, the room, were fading, and grateful slumber approached and weighed upon his eyes in the form of that dazzling globe. The feeling of contentment was the last impression which he had, ere, with the bright star seemingly suspended just beyond the netting, he slept. Chapter 15. The Witch Queen. A man mentally overtired sleeps either dreamlessly or dreams with a vividness greater than that characterizing the dreams of normal slumber. Dr. Cairn dreamt a vivid dream. He dreamt that he was awakened by the sound of a gentle rapping. Opening his eyes, he peered through the cloudy netting. He started up and wrenched back the curtain. The rapping was repeated, and peering again across the room, he very distinctly perceived a figure upon the balcony by the open window. It was that of a woman who wore the black silk dress and the white yashmak of the Moslem, and who was bending forward, looking into the room.
"Who is there?" he called. "What do you want?"
"Shh." The woman raised her hand to her veiled lips and looked right and left, as if fearing to disturb the occupants of the adjacent rooms. Dr. Cairn reached out for his dressing gown, which lay upon the chair beside the bed, threw it over his shoulders, and stepped out upon the floor. He stooped and put on his slippers, never taking his eyes from the figure at the window. The room was flooded with moonlight. He began to walk towards the balcony when the mysterious visitor spoke.
"You are Dr. Cairn?"
The words were spoken in the language of dreams, that is to say, that although he understood them perfectly, he knew that they had not been uttered in the English language, nor in any language known to him. Yet as is the way with one who dreams, he had understood.
I am he, he said. Who are you?
Make no noise, but follow me quickly. Someone is very ill.
There was sincerity in the appeal, spoken in the softest, most silvern tone which he had ever heard. He stood beside the veiled woman, and met the glance of her dark eyes with a consciousness of some magnetic force in the glance, which seemed to set his nerves quivering.
Why do you come to the window? How do you know?
The visitor raised her hand again to her lips. It was of a gleaming ivory color, and the long, tapered fingers were laden with singular jewelry, exquisite enamel work, which he knew to be ancient Egyptian, but which did not seem out of place in this dream adventure.
I was afraid to make any unnecessary disturbance, she replied. Please do not delay, but come at once.
Dr. Cairn adjusted his dressing gown and followed the veiled messenger along the balcony. For a dream city, Port Said appeared remarkably substantial, as it spread out at his feet, its dingy buildings whitened by the moonlight. But his progress was dreamlike, for he seemed to glide past many windows, around the corner of the building, and without having consciously exerted any physical effort, found his hands grasped by warm, jeweled fingers, found himself guided into some darkened room, and then, possessed by that doubting which sometimes comes in dreams, found himself hesitating. The moonlight did not penetrate to the apartment in which he stood, and the darkness about him was impenetrable. But the clinging fingers did not release their hold, and vaguely aware that he was acting in a manner which might readily be misconstrued, he nevertheless allowed his unseen guide to lead him forward. Stairs were descended in phantom silence, many stairs. The coolness of the air suggested that they were outside the hotel, but the darkness remained complete. Along what seemed to be a stone-paved passage, they advanced mysteriously. And by this time, Dr. Cairn was wholly resigned to the strangeness of his dream. Then, although the place lay in blackest shadow, he saw that they were in the open air, for the starry sky swept above them. It was a narrow street. At points, the buildings almost met above, wherein he now found himself. In reality, had he been in possession of his usual faculties, awake, he would have asked himself how this veiled woman had gained admittance to the hotel, and why she had secretly led him out from it. But the dreamer's mental lethargy possessed him, and with the blind faith of a child he followed on, until he now began vaguely to consider the personality of his guide. She seemed to be of no more than average height, but she carried herself with unusual grace, and her progress was marked by a certain hauteur. At the point where a narrow lane crossed that which they were traversing, the veiled figure was silhouetted for a moment against the light of the moon, and through the gauze-like fabric he perceived the outlines of a perfect shape. His vague wonderment concerned itself now with the ivory, jewel-laden hands. His condition differed from the normal dream state, in that he was not entirely resigned to the anomalous. Misty doubts were forming, when his dream guide paused before a heavy door of a typical native house, which once had been of some consequence, and which faced the entrance to a mosque, indeed lay in the shadow of the minaret. It was opened from within, although she gave no perceptible signal, and its darkness, to Dr. Cairn's dulled perceptions, seemed to swallow them both up. He had an impression of a trap raised, of stone steps descended, of a new darkness, almost palpable. The gloom of the place affected him as a mental blank, and when a bright light shone out, it seemed to mark the opening of a second dream phase. From where the light came, he knew not, cared not, but it illuminated a perfectly bare room, with a floor of native mud bricks, a plastered wall, and wood-beamed ceiling. A tall sarcophagus stood upright against the wall before him, its lid leant close beside it, and his black-robed guide, her luminous eyes looking straightly over the yashmak, stood rigidly upright within it. She raised the jeweled hands, and with a swift movement discarded robe and yashmak and stood before him in the clinging draperies of an ancient queen, wearing the leopard skin and the uraeus, and carrying the flail of royal Egypt. Her pale face formed a perfect oval. The long almond eyes had an evil beauty which seemed to chill, and the brilliantly red mouth was curved in a smile which must have made any man forget the evil in the eyes. But when we move in a dream world, our emotions become dreamlike too. She placed a sandaled foot upon the mud floor and stepped out of the sarcophagus, advancing towards Dr. Cairn, a vision of such sinful loveliness as he could never have conceived in his waking moments. In that strange dream language, in a tongue not of east nor west, she spoke, and her silvern voice had something of the tone of those Egyptian pipes whose dray fills the nights upon the upper Nile, the seductive music of remote and splendid wickedness.
"You know me now," she whispered.
And in his dream, she seemed to be a familiar figure, at once dreadful and worshipful. A fitful light played through the darkness and seemed to dance upon a curtain draped behind the sarcophagus, picking out diamond points. The dreamer groped in the mental chaos of his mind and found a clue to the meaning of this. The diamond points were the eyes of thousands of tarantula spiders with which the curtain was broidered. The sign of the spider. What did he know of it? Yes, of course. It was the secret mark of Egypt's witch queen, of the beautiful woman whose name, after her mysterious death, had been erased from all her monuments. A sweet whisper stole to his ears.
"You will befriend him. Befriend my son for my sake."
And in his dream state, he found himself prepared to forswear all that he held holy for her sake. She grasped both his hands, and her burning eyes looked closely into his.
"Your reward shall be a great one," she whispered, even more softly.
Came a sudden blank, and Dr. Cairn found himself walking again through the narrow street led by the veiled woman. His impressions were growing dim, and now she seemed less real than hitherto. The streets were phantom streets, built of shadow stuff, and the stairs which presently he found himself ascending were unsubstantial, and he seemed rather to float upward, until, with the jeweled fingers held fast in his own, he stood in a darkened apartment and saw before him an open window, knew that he was once more back in the hotel. A dim light dawned in the blackness of the room, and the musical voice breathed in his ear.
"Your reward shall be easily earned. I did but test you. Strike, and strike truly."
The whisper grew sibilant, serpentine. Dr. Cairn felt the hilt of a dagger thrust into his right hand, and in the dimly mysterious light looked down at one who lay in a bed close beside him. At the sight of the face of the sleeper, the perfectly chiseled face, with the long black lashes resting on the ivory cheeks, he forgot all else, forgot the place wherein he stood, forgot his beautiful guide, and only remembered that he held a dagger in his hand and that Antony Ferrara lay there sleeping.
"Strike!"
came the whisper again. Dr. Cairn felt a mad exultation boiling up within him. He raised his hand, glanced once more on the face of the sleeper, and nerved himself to plunge the dagger into the heart of this evil thing. A second more, and the dagger would have been buried to the hilt in the sleeper's breast, when there ensued a deafening and appalling explosion. A wild red light illuminated the room. The building seemed to rock. Close upon that frightful sound followed a cry so piercing that it seemed to ice the blood in Dr. Cairn's veins.
"Stop, sir! Stop! My God, what are you doing?"
A swift blow struck the dagger from his hand, and the figure on the bed sprang upright. Swaying dizzily, Dr. Cairn stood there in the darkness, and as the voice of awakened sleepers reached his ears from adjoining rooms, the electric light was switched on, and across the bed upon which he had thought Antony Ferrara lay, he saw his son, Robert Cairn. No one else was in the room, but on the carpet at his feet lay an ancient dagger, the hilt covered with beautiful and intricate gold and enamel work. Rigid with a mutual horror, these two so strangely met stood staring at one another across the room. Everyone in the hotel, it would appear, had been awakened by the explosion, which, as if by the intervention of God, had stayed the hand of Dr. Cairn, had spared him from a deed impossible to contemplate. There were sounds of running footsteps everywhere, but the origin of the disturbance at that moment had no interest for these two. Robert was the first to break the silence.
"Merciful God, sir," he whispered huskily, "how did you come to be here? What is the matter? Are you ill?"
Dr. Cairn extended his hands like one groping in darkness.
"Rob, give me a moment to think, to collect myself. Why am I here? By all that is wonderful, why are you here?"
"I am here to meet you."
"To meet me? I had no idea that you were well enough for the journey. And if you had come to meet me, why..."
"That's it, sir. Why did you send me that wireless?"
"I sent no wireless, boy."
Robert Cairn, with a little color returning to his pale cheeks, advanced and grasped his father's hand.
"But after I arrived here to meet the boat, sir, I received a wireless from the P&O due in the morning to say that you had changed your mind and come via Brindisi."
Dr. Cairn glanced at the dagger upon the carpet, repressed a shudder, and replied in a voice which he struggled to make firm.
"I did not send that wireless."
"Then you actually came by the boat which arrived last night? And to think that I was asleep in the same hotel. What an amazing..."
"Amazing indeed, Rob. And the result of a cunning and well-planned scheme."
He raised his eyes, looking fixedly at his son.
"You understand the scheme. The scheme that could only have germinated in one mind. A scheme to cause me, your father, to..."
His voice failed, and again his glance sought the weapon which lay so close to his feet. Partly in order to hide his emotion, he stooped, picked up the dagger, and threw it on the bed.
"For God's sake, sir," groaned Robert. "What were you doing here in my room? With that?"
Dr. Cairn stood straightly upright and replied in an even voice.
"I was here to do murder."
"Murder?"
"I was under a spell. No need to name its weaver. I thought that a poisonous thing at last lay at my mercy, and by cunning means the primitive evil within me was called up, and braving the laws of God and man, I was about to slay that thing. Thank God."
He dropped upon his knees, silently bowed his head for a moment, and then stood up, self-possessed again, as his son had always known him. It had been a strange and awful awakening for Robert Cairn, to find his room illuminated by a lurid light, and to find his own father standing over him with a knife. But what had moved him even more deeply than the fear of these things had been the sight of the emotion which had shaken that stern and unemotional man. Now, as he gathered together his scattered wits, he began to perceive that a malignant hand was moving above them, that his father and himself were pawns, which had been moved mysteriously to a dreadful end. This is B.J. Harrison. I hope you've enjoyed this unabridged production of The Night of the Necropolis, Part 2 of 8 by Sax Rohmer. If you have enjoyed this book, please visit our website at classictalesaudiobooks.com and pick up your copy of 813, the fourth Arzen Lupin adventure. And please rate and review us if you can. It really helps other folks to find our show. Thank you for joining me today and allowing classic literature to awaken your better self. Please join me every week, and we'll rediscover the greatest stories ever put to paper.